You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Me just coughing on air to start off the show of the year. Tēnā koutou katoa. Ko Mary Margaret's like, tōku ingoa. No mai haere mai ki te wai mo tēnei rā. Kia ora everyone, welcome to the first Thursday Wire of 2020. I'm your host Mary Margaret Slack and I'll be with you for the next hour, and I'm also joined by our fresh Wire producer, Sam Denny. Kia ora. He's been an absolute gem in the newsroom since 2019, so we're very excited to have him here today.
I'm very excited to be here, yeah. If not slightly brimming with stress.
Yeah, it's I've been explaining to Sam that the stress levels of The Wire don't really change. The only thing that changes is you, and you numb to it. So
build a tolerance.
Yeah, I mean, it's like everything, right?
Yeah, just flex those muscles.
Woohoo!
Yeah,
get all stretched up.
My patience muscles gonna be like real big and bulk.
So we're all stretched up for the show today. We've got Neighbourhood Watch with Radio Adelaide Zoe Canandis about everything that's happened over the holidays, mainly the fires. I'm bringing an exclusive update on the construction here at Auckland Uni and how it's affecting little old 95BFM. Sam speaks to Sapna Samant about her planned protest to show solidarity with, is it students in India?
Yeah, so there's been widespread students and women majoritively have been.
Some of my favourite people.
Yeah.
And finally, we check in with Children's Commissioner Andrew Beecroft about the first announcement as part of a review of Oranga Tamariki. My regular callers know how much I love to hear from you guys. Do get in touch. Tukipatuhi mai, text us on 5395 or YMI, give us a call on 309 3879. Even if it's just a sweet little story from your summer, I want to hear it.
You call that a news update? This is a news update. It's Neighbourhood Watch.
It is indeed, and I caught up with Zoe this morning to talk everything from fires to the debate about the Indigenous heritage of a man that we have deemed inappropriate. I served a couple customers from Adelaide at the restaurant that I work at the other day, and they said that like they woke up one day and some smoke had come up to their end.
Yeah. So we had some pretty significant fires just before the end of the year, and then in the past we've had the Kangaroo Island fires, and then wind bringing all that smoke across to Adelaide. So the air quality hasn't been great in Adelaide. I personally just haven't stopped sneezing for what feels like 3 weeks. In saying that, though, I think Victoria are getting a really... Their air quality has been hazardous for a very long time.
Mm. I mean, on that topic, I told you I'm coming to Melbourne this weekend. Do I need...
Very exciting.
It is exciting, but do I need an air mask? My mum wants me to pack one.
In all seriousness, I think maybe packing one if you had one already, but also maybe grabbing one when you're in the state as well couldn't hurt. Although
yeah.
We have seen some rain and some cooler weather, which did bring the air quality down from hazardous to good in Melbourne yesterday. But it is this really surreal new reality that, especially in Victoria, I've seen some people tweeting about how they've had discussions with their kids on how they're going to decorate their P2 masks. And it's this really surreal reality that we're all facing. And, you know, what's the future going to be like if this is what it's like now?
Mm. Climate change babies, eh?
Yeah, and it's been a really, as I said, like a tough start to the year, especially in the past week. We've seen so many disruptions, especially across Melbourne, everything from sporting events. I mean, the horse races got cancelled, which I think is probably a good thing. And we've seen, you know, this videos of tennis players collapsing in coughing fits, and stats and things like the air, breathing in the air is the equivalent to a packet of cigarettes a day.
There being, widespread protest, is it sort of reinvigorating a form of consciousness about climate change in Australia, do you think?
Yeah, you know, it's a weird silver lining because I was at the rally in Adelaide on Friday, and thousands of people were there, hundreds of thousands of people were there, you know, blocking off the entire main street of Adelaide. And it has brought this issue to the forefront of so many minds now. Maybe even people who weren't quite as convinced, so to speak. It's you can't not be convinced when you are struggling to breathe and you're also watching so many communities and people suffer horrific, you know, loss of life, loss of animals and property. It's hard to not... It's so in your face now that it even more so has brought it to the forefront of everyone's minds. And I think especially to some who aren't convinced, but just not the government, unfortunately.
Yeah. I mean, before we get to that, just on that note about it being at the forefront of the general public's mind, you know, there have been Aboriginal Australians talking about the destructive impacts of climate change for years. Do you think this issue is sort of leading to more visibility of that fact?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, our Indigenous people who own this land, you know, they've been dealing with these things and have so much more understanding of the landscapes and their country than colonisers have been in the past, I think, 200 years. It's really interesting to see now that there is a large voice and community that want to be able to put this care back into their hands because they understand it so much better. And it's so true, like, since this country has been colonised, climate change has, and it's so much more evident with these fires, is absolutely ruining this country and their home and their land, and it's really devastating. But it has definitely brought a lot more visibility to that issue.
Yeah. Obviously, one of the biggest things standing in the way of handing that care back to the hands of Aboriginal people is, at the moment, Scott Morrison. What's happening in terms of public reception of him? You mentioned he's declined in the polls. Do you think that's just because he's an idiot, or what's going on there?
Yeah, so as you would all know, he was sort of in Hawaii at the start of this issue and has come back, and there's been videos of him out in communities, you know, forcibly shaking people's hands. There's videos of firefighters, I'm sure you've all seen them, videos of firefighters essentially pulling up to news crews and having their word and saying their piece about Scott Morrison. There is a huge dislike for him at the moment in terms of his response to these fires. Not even really, I mean, on a climate change issue as well, but also on just a general leadership of the country during a crisis. This is the worst bushfires, you know, we've seen in such a long time, and just to have a leader that isn't showing that leadership is absolutely the reason why his popularity has declined in the polls. So the Labor leader is now more popular. However, the Liberal Party, Scott Morrison's Liberal Party, is still the preferred party, but Scott Morrison isn't the preferred leader, which maybe comments a little bit on the Australian tool poppy syndrome. We associate a person a lot with issues, and so it makes sense to me that Liberal would still be the preferred party in the polls, because Australians definitely like to put a lot of energy into disliking someone and blaming someone.
Yeah. Wow. And so even if there is, you know, increased invisibility of the devastating effects of climate change, do you think it will actually translate into a shift in policy?
Yeah, I think so. I think we've seen Scott Morrison finally kind of give funding to our firefighters. So if you don't know, our firefighters, especially the CFS, volunteer-based, and they don't have any funding from the government that was cut. So he's given funding to them now, but he's actually taken that out of the National Disability Scheme, which is already a completely underfunded, underappreciated scheme as well. So in saying that, this change of policy has also brought devastation amongst another group of people. So it's hard to see any future. I mean, I feel like we have just sort of come out of this period where the fires have been awful. You know, people are just sort of giving what they can, donating, giving their time, trying to spread awareness, trying to help friends and family who are involved in these fires. And I think when the dust settles, so to speak, hopefully then this country can start to have a real conversation around climate change policy, funding policies for firefighters, and trying to look to the future. Because, I mean, if this, we've got till, I think, March, April is when this fire season ends, and then what, it just happens again in August, like it was starting in August this year, last year already. So it's not much time to think. So hopefully, when the dust settles, we can actually really have a real conversation about this.
Yeah, kia ora. So we'll finish on the last topic that you wanted to chat to me about today. Tell us a little bit about who Bruce Pascoe is and what's happened to him.
So just a reminder that this sort of situation was happening whilst all the fires were happening. So it was a really unusual move from Peter Dutton to sort of bring this up at a time where the country is going through an absolute crisis. But Indigenous author Bruce Pascoe was, he had a letter sent to essentially questioning his Indigenous heritage, right? He's been fighting the fires this whole time, and then a businesswoman by the name of, her name is Miss Cashman, she sent a letter to Peter Dutton, allegedly saying that Bruce was claiming to be Indigenous in order to reap the quote-unquote, you know, benefits from that, which is a really hurtful statement. And then so Peter Dutton decides to refer this letter to the Australian Federal Police to investigate whether Bruce Pascoe was lying about this or not. This also brought a call to register, I can't even say this, have a registry for Indigenous people, which is such, like, I'm trying to be unbiased here, but I mean, registering a race, could you, and in this colonial country, we've invaded this land and we want to, you know, there's these calls to register Indigenous people. What a disgusting slippery slope that is. I mean, if history has taught us anything, it's something that we should not be doing. But Peter Dutton and Miss Cashman, you know, wanted to sort of do this around this situation of Bruce Pascoe, and it's all very messy. Bruce Pascoe says that he is very hurt after this incident, and also he had been in his home fighting these fires as well, so he's also going through this absolute catastrophe in his own life, and it's really devastating to see. We have seen calls though from Ken White, who is the Liberal Indigenous Minister, say that this is super unnecessary, really not okay. We've also seen Bill Shorten, who I learnt was the Indigenous Affairs Minister for Labor, also saying, again, this is very unnecessary, super awful, hurtful, and also the entire concept of trying to register a race is quite vile.
And just as an outsider, it sounds to me really comparable to the tactics of apartheid South Africa.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, really scary stuff.
And furthermore, for a country who is still failing to recognise the authority of their Indigenous people, it seems odd that they're more caught up in debating the Indigenous position of one particular person.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you said it perfectly. You know, Mr. Pascoe doesn't know this woman who's sort of written this letter to Peter Dutton. It's just really weird. It seems like it's settling right now. I'm really glad it didn't become so much of a national debate either.
Also,
people just seem to realise that this is actually quite silly.
That was Neighbourhood Watch. Ripper.
That was indeed Neighbourhood Watch. Thank you to Zoe Kunandas for joining us for another week. We're going to take a break now. I'm going to get a drink of water. Hashtag hydration check. Make sure you do too. I'm going to leave you with some gigs. Send me a text if you were at Northern Base this year. I saw DEE and he literally made eye contact with me while I was dancing, like, quite manically. So I thought I'd pay some homage to Grime. So we're going to play Look What the Cat Dragged In.
Buy your music.
Yeah. contracted. Look what they contracted. Look what they contracted. Look what they contracted. Cream of the crop shit. I got chicks who scheming to what gigs. You feeling my hot shit. BB wanna lean in my cockpit. Feel on my chopsticks. Diabetes, fiend in the chocolate. Beating it off shit. Have a threesome, peas in a pod shit. I'm a beat artist. I done it bareback, I take chances. Street nasty, I ain't glancing. I'm a breast man, but I rate arses. Late parties, but I ain't dancing. Confossier filling up 8 glasses. VIP shit, 8 passes. Something freaky for me to take part in. Look at the swag, that's him. Hold on, man, look at the man stacks in. Look at his kicks and the hats matching. Look what the cat dragged in. This ain't your average bling. Look at him, this ain't an average thing. Look what the cat dragged. Push up your black flag. What came round, best just rang. Nuts came down. My little slut playground. I was guilty but I'm a boss case now. I wanna touch base now. I want my cock cape round. Look round the knock's face smile. I made the sluts go wild. Told the man them do not argue. Knox toilet, pop bathroom. Holler man's nice, top classroom. Best still ringing saying he might pass through. My little light castle. Cause holler man's packaging the right parcel. That slim shady, like Marshall. And Spence still coming with a nice car full. Look at the swag, that's him. Holler man, who gets the mad stacks in. Look at his kicks and the hats matching. Look what the cat dragged in. This ain't your average bling. Look at him, this ain't an average thing. Look what the cat dragged. Push up your black flag.
Wow, what a perfect day for a cool, refreshing Kiwi craft beer. You want something?
Just one of whatever you're getting.
Well, there's heaps to choose from.
I'm easy.
You're easy?
Yeah, I'm easy.
Let's take it slow. Here, we can try it before we buy. Easy, no worries.
I'm not worried.
Get yourself a craft beer education this summer at 16 Tonne, where craft beer is as easy as 3, 2, 1. 16 Tonne, Jellicoe Street, Wynyard Quarter. Go to 16tonne.co.nz or check them out on Instagram and Untapped.
Doctor, doctor, I've been feeling very hot all the time.
Go on.
I'm also incredibly anxious about how I look.
Well, this is very straightforward. I prescribe a Swiss News summer wardrobe post-haste.
Not therapy?
Retail therapy.
Refresh your wardrobe this summer at Taddy's Designer Recycle. Take your unwanted summer clothes in now and refill your clothes rack with some breezy new threads. Taddy's Designer Recycle, 161 Ponsonby Road and 47 High Street.
Are you a real doctor?
Oh my god, aren't you absolutely pumped for Laneway?
I actually have work.
Pop by after work. Party!
I have to give my uncle's cat her medicine.
Well, get someone else to.
Oh no.
But you'll listen on BFM, yeah?
Yeah, cat likes the radio.
Can't make it to Laneway? Never fear. 95BFM will be broadcasting live all day, direct and from the fest thanks to Atomic Coffee Roasters. 95BFM live from Laneway, Monday, January 27th, only on 95BFM.
Around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
Yes, welcome back to The Wire. We were just talking about how anxiety-inducing the construction sounds can
be. Yeah, crikey dingo, eh?
Like, what was your experience of it, Sam?
Okay, so when I was editing my piece before, I was just, like, gritting my teeth because, as you'll know, Mary Margaret, the computers that we have here are about as good as, like, you know, the old stone tablets that
absolutely
they had in, like, the fucking Stone Age and that. But, yeah, the audio output of them is really low and there's just these diggers and these, like, bloody concrete destroying machines.
I've got an impersonation
off
of them. Yeah.
You nearly broke into a swirr.
Yeah, I know, right? So I decided to come fresh with a report on the construction this morning. Here we go.
Kia ora te whanau. It's Mary Margaret Slack here. I'm just stood outside the main entrance of 95BFM and... if you can hear below me, all the sounds of the construction, which has stood in the way of every single one of our interviews this morning. So I just wanted to give you guys an insight to what Radio B is dealing with as we enter 2020. This is the sound of a new decade of student radio. I'm just joined right now by Program Director Sarah Thompson. What was your experience when you came back to BFM from the summer holidays? It is home, isn't it?
I'd been back for a little bit, but I came in to do my show on the weekend, and a board covering the back stairs, which is the only entrance in and out of BFM currently, had been completely boarded over, meaning not only could I not get in to do my show, they'd boarded Danielle inside, which was quite intense.
Were any construction workers around at the time?
No, but apparently the construction workers who did it had seen Danielle walk up the stairs and then still boarded her in, which is, depending on which way you want to look at it, quite funny.
Or just a lot of fun for them on their routine days, I suppose.
Maybe they thought there was another way out of the building. There wasn't.
An honest mistake, but yet another example of a major disturbance to 95BFM as we enter the new decade of student radio. Excuse me, are you a summer school student?
Yeah.
Can I ask you for the student radio upstairs, 95BFM, about if the construction has been a disturbance to your learning?
Go for it. Not really, all my classes are really far away from here, so it's...
What if you were in the science centre?
That would really suck. That's really, really obnoxiously loud.
What do you study?
I'm doing arts, so global studies degree.
So you're further enough away that it's not bothering you?
Yeah, no.
Do you have any condolences to address to any of the students around this area?
Good God, I'm sorry. I put you somewhere else for summer school at least. I mean, half the place is empty, so.
Amazing. Thank you so much. Kia ora.
Kia ora.
So, I am now joined by David Syke, who also just happens to be my father, but was a guest on 95BFM this morning. What was your experience getting into the building with all the construction? Did it confuse you?
Utterly. Geez, I didn't know where I was. And there was a sign that told me to go one way, but that just led me to nothing but barriers. So I just kept looking around and... following my detailed instructions from yesterday, which even with that assistance was still baffling.
How long did it take you to get in? Were you late for the interview?
No, it wasn't that bad.
Okay.
I'm a smart thinker, you know that.
Yeah. But I mean, this isn't about you. This is about how terribly this is setting up the decade ahead of student radio.
Yes, well, I would say that's true. And it does make you wonder just how long it's going to go, because just to extend this analogy of family experience, you'll recall that the high school you went to had shrink wrap around it for, God, it must be 5 years or more.
Something like that.
And it does kind of, not to be too flippant about it, it does make the... business of getting educated a little bit complicated.
Doesn't it just? Asked a student at this morning. Did you could you hear all the drilling when you were talking on air this morning?
Actually, no. I have to say, well, once I was in the studio, it wasn't all that much of an imposition. But I'm also aware that earlier on in the process, they actually boarded up the access so that you had people in the studio who couldn't get back out, which is, you know, suboptimal.
Oh, yes. And one time in December, though, and the reason that I got in is because I used my grumpy voice that David Slack taught me.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Someone just texted in saying, get over it, it's called building. That's what I call a lighthearted, jokey piece. But anyway, on a more serious note, what's up, Sam?
So, today I spoke to Sapna.
Oh my God! I have her last name written down somewhere.
Sapna Sedan.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I spoke to her about the protest, which is going to be going on Sunday at Jean Batten Place, walking up to Myers Park. And What the protest is concerning is what's been happening in India regarding the Citizens Amendment Act.
Okay.
Citizenship Amendment Act, which has basically redesignated the status of Muslim refugees and not allowing them to actually access their refugee status under Indian law. Now, there's been a bunch of protests which have happened on universities over the past few months, and then like increased policing, both physical violent arrests, and then on top of that there's been policing of what people have been posting on social media. And yeah, so basically there's this protest. It starts at midday down at Jean Batten Place, which is just off Fort Street, midday Sunday the 19th of Jan.
Cool. Well, let's learn all about it.
So I just want to ask a few questions about the protest, which has been organised for Sunday the 19th of January. Before we kick off, could you possibly explain a bit of the context surrounding the protests that have already been happening in India?
So this has been ongoing for a couple of years, but to keep it really, really brief, the government of India amended the Citizenship Act, which is in the Constitution of India, where, you know, everybody, where they consider citizenship for migrants coming into India. To what they did was they amended it to illegal migrants, this is into quotation marks, illegal migrants from Afghanistan, Bangladesh and Pakistan before 2014 will be considered for citizenship of India, except Muslims. Bear in mind that all of these three countries are Muslim countries. So they, if there are any refugees, I would not call them illegal migrants, I would call them refugees. If there are any refugees coming into the country, into India, they're coming there for a reason. And to discriminate just based on religion is just completely unconstitutional and discriminatory. The Constitution of India is a secular and progressive document. The preamble contains the word secular, and everybody is treated as an equal. So they've amended this. That is just one, which is the Citizenship Amendment Act. But they've also implemented something called the National Register of Citizens, first implemented in the state of Assam, to identify Muslims and Bangladeshi illegal immigrants, and they will be, you know, there will be a register, and if they're not on that register, then they're deemed illegal and they'll be put into a detention center. And what has happened is that this basically a lot of people who've lived there forever and who don't have documents. I mean, if you're in a remote village somewhere, a deep rural area, how are you going to present documents? You're just born there and you die there. But if you don't have documents, then you're illegal, and therefore you'll be picked up and put in a detention center. So changing the fabric of Assam, this national NRC is going to be implemented across India now. And the third thing that has happened is that they're going to start something called a National Population Register, which where people will go, you know, these officials will go from house to house documenting people and asking for papers. They're not yet sure which papers, because your passport is not eligible, your birth certificate is not eligible, so they've not actually told us what is eligible for the, you know, what is a legal document. And so all of that has caused a lot of unrest in India, because people think this government, which has got a fascist ideology, is converting this secular, pluralistic nation into a patriarchal Hindu nation.
Could you talk about who comprises the government at the moment a little bit, and what the ruling ideology of the government at the moment is?
The Prime Minister of India is Narendra Modi. The Bharatiya Janata Party, or the BJP, is the majority party in this government, and they were voted. India has the first passport, and they were re-elected into government just recently last year. And so they're a party that comes from a philosophy of Hindutva, which is, so Hinduism is the religion, and this party is a philosophy which is Hindutva, which is that, you know, this is the superior, Hinduism is a superior religion, Hindus are superior to everybody else, you know, they it's very race-based as well, so the Hindus like to, that particular belief likes to think that they come from the Aryans or Aryans, which is very similar to what the Nazis thought. And in fact, the founders of all the parties that has now come up as the BJP, they all idolized Adolf Hitler, and they believed that the German way, the Nazi German way, was the best way. A lot of people who do not fit into their worldview, it'll affect somebody like me, perhaps, who, you know, I'm a New Zealand citizen, but I have something called an overseas citizenship of India, which means I can come and go as I please. It could affect me because I could be deemed anti-national and not allowed into the country. Yeah, and the other things that have happened, which, I mean, these are overtly, you know, citizenship-related legislations, but there's been a slow erosion of justice over a period of time where, you know, Kashmir had special status in the Constitution of India under Article 370, and the government has, you know, abrogated that article in August last year, August 2019. And after maybe more than 160 days now, they've just partially lifted blanket internet ban in Kashmir. So, you know, instead of, I mean, Kashmir has had a really turbulent past, and there was an exodus of Kashmiri pundits who are Hindus from the state, which is really a terrible thing. But instead of reconciliation and healing, what we see is punishment and you know, sort of genocidal language being used. And while while the rest of India perhaps, because Kashmir has been such an issue, rest of India perhaps never paid attention to that, thinking that, well, you know, they're troublemakers anyway, all the Kashmiri Muslims. But just a couple of, I think last month, the Supreme Court passed a judgment on a piece of land that held a masjid that was, broken down by BJP and its Hindu affiliates in 1992, 6th of December 1992, and that's been ongoing because they believe that there was a Hindu temple underneath that. This is a 400-year-old structure, the masjid, and that is a mosque, and they decided that this is, you know, suddenly they decided there was a temple underneath, and so they broke it down. And so there's been court case after court case, there's been riots after riots in India over this issue.
Yeah.
And the Supreme Court actually, it was a really weak judgment where they said, well, yeah, there's no proof that there was a temple underneath this structure. However, we are giving the land to the Hindutva people. I think it's been building up this erosion and this, you know, being called anti-India if you raise your voice, any critique that happens. So the anger's been building up. Plus the economy is at its worst over the last 45 years. Since 45 years, I would say.
Wow.
The economy is at its worst since 45 years. Unemployment rates are high. There's been job losses. A lot of state structures being privatized. And there's no plan. I mean, you could say that, you know, this, you want to build a free market capitalist society where, you know, individual responsibility is what it should be. But that's not even the plan. The plan is just haphazard, whatever comes into their brain, because ultimately the aim is to have a Hindu nation. So, I mean, if people die of hunger, who cares? You know?
Wow.
That's
a lot to take in, and it sounds like a really ripe sort of breeding ground for injustice. And you know, as someone that doesn't have a comprehensive understanding of the political situation in India, it's really concerning to hear these things, you know, especially because part of it sounds like history is sort of playing itself back.
Yeah,
in ways, with the desecration of sacred sites, with the door-to-door knocking, the registers, and the amendment to the Citizenship Act, like determining who is and who isn't valid. It's all very, very scary stuff. I'd just like to ask what the response from the community has been like. How have people responded to this legislation being put forth and these new changes to citizenship and to the register, what have people been doing? Have they been taking action in any way?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, you know, this simmering discontent over a period of time that became visible when students from the Jamia Millia Islamia University in Delhi, they protested. It was a peaceful protest inside on campus, but the police entered the campus and they were sort of non-state agents, for want of a better term, sanctioned by the state, but non-state agents who vandalized the library and, you know, beat up students. And that just blew up because other universities, students at other universities started protesting. So after JMI was vandalized, another university called the Aligarh Muslim University, which is, you know, prestigious university. All the three universities that have been targeted are prestigious universities, old universities, very intellectual breeding ground, you know, breeding ground for intellectual and critical thinking. Mm-hmm. So JMI was targeted first because they protested peacefully. Then Aligarh Muslim University, who stood up in solidarity, they were targeted next. And then the Jawaharlal Nehru University, which is in Delhi as well, there's been ongoing targeting by the BJP government of this particular university for a really long time. It's a bastion of socialists and leftist thought. You know, if you sort of want to stereotype them.
Yeah.
So the student leaders have been, you know, targeted by calling them the anti-India gang and the breakup, you know, there's a word phrase called Tukde Tukde gang. Tukde means pieces. So this is the, you know, the pieces gang that wants to break up India kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so just in the first week of January, masked goons entered this campus and they beat up the students. One of the student leaders was beaten up. She started bleeding. You know, she got a deep gash on her head. And that's when I think people just really got upset because, you know, middle-class India, as long as it's not affecting their lives, they'll just carry on, which is what middle-class people all over the world do.
Yeah.
You know, everything is top high until it starts coming to their doors. But they have children who are students and who are enlightened and have a world view, and they feel disrespected and they feel trampled upon. And so it's just erupted across the nation.
Mm-hmm.
There's this another place in Delhi called Shaheen Bagh where they have this 24-hour sit-in. It's just full of Indian women. You know, the youngest protester a couple of days ago was a 20-year-old baby.
Whoa.
And the oldest one was the mom had the baby and she took her to this place. The oldest one is a 90-year-old woman, you know. These are largely Muslim women who would not step out because they didn't feel the need to step out, but this is their place in India being questioned, and I think they need to stand up, and then mm-hmm. everybody else is allying with them. You know, we have to support each other.
I've read that things have actually extended as far as the policing of social media posts, and people have actually been detained for posting things on like sites like Facebook and Instagram that have been deemed as un-Indian. That is correct. Wow.
That is correct. I mean, that's largely happened in India, but you know, I mean, there was this one person who, before we had our first, we had a rally on the 21st of December and to protest against this. And there was this one person, Indian person, who posted on his Facebook, who lives in New Zealand, who posted on his Facebook page publicly to say that, oh, the you know, this is an anti-India activity and the High Commission of India is watching these people and their privileges will be cut. So I wouldn't be surprised if I'm being, you know, I'm on the radar.
Is there anything you'd like to say in the event that you are?
I'm sure I am. I actually wrote to the Indian High Commission of India last week, and I also wrote to MFAT and the Prime Minister's Office of the Chief Executive, you know, pointing out that, okay, so, you know, I'm not naive enough to think that you do not surveil citizens for potential anti-whatever activities that do not suit that current agenda. But are you, so this is specifically to the High Commission of India, are you actually allowing another Indian to threaten, you know, an Indian to threaten another Indian, saying that your privileges will be cut? Or are you actually, you know, this means that it's not just in New Zealand, you're potentially doing it to Indians all over the world, and are you just going to, you know, cut their privileges to visit India? And it's really not a comfortable place to be in, because you're actually saying that we cannot exercise our rights in this country, in a secular democracy, to protest something that's happening in India. So, you know, under the Bill of Rights, we can do this protest without actually being...
So there's a march happening in Auckland this Sunday, the 19th of January. What can you tell me about this march, and where is it leaving from, and where is it heading to?
We're having this march to condemn the government, the fascist government of India, and to stand in solidarity with all the students and all the protesters back in India. We will meet up at 12 noon at Jean Batten Place, and then we'll slowly make our way up to Myers Park. And we know we it's going to be songs and chants. There's not going to be any speeches. What we want to make visible is this ongoing unrest in India and the reason for it. And we would like the government of New Zealand to take notice of this and condemn this fascism, because it's very much related to those white supremacy and the kind of Islamophobia and hatred that led to Christchurch, you know, 15th of March. So which is why we're having this march. Oh, 15th of March.
What sort of response would you like to see from the government?
We would like Prime Minister Ardern to condemn this fascism and to say that this is, you know, an erosion of democracy. It's an acknowledgement, I would say, of ongoing unrest and how it is going to affect South Asia geopolitically. And ultimately, it's going to land up at the doorstep of Aotearoa, isn't it? And we don't want that. We want this government of India to stop discriminating against its own people based on religion.
Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
So that was me talking to Dr. Sapna Samant about some of the context of what's going on in India at the moment, some of the changes to legislation there, and particularly looking at the protest movements which have been occurring both in India and worldwide. In Auckland, if you want to get involved, there's a protest march on Sunday, the 19th of January, which is this Sunday, and it will be convening down at Jean Batten Place, which is just off Fort Lane, CBD, off Queen Street, 12 p.m. walking up to Myers Park to end at about 2 p.m.
Cool.
Get involved.
Yeah, get amongst. It's an excellent cause. Maybe we'll go along, do some corresponding from there. Because shout out to Sapna, she was amazing.
Sapna is a G.
Yeah. All right, we'll be right back after a break. This is Staggerly by Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds.
It was back in 32 when times were hard. He had a Colt 45 and a deck of cards. Staggerly.
wore rat-drawn shoes and an old Stetson hat. Had a 2840, had payments on that steadily. His woman threw him out on the ice and the snow, and she told him never ever come back no more. Steadily. So he walked through the rain and he walked through the mud till he came to a place called the Bucket of Blood. Steadily. He said, Mr. Motherfucker, you know who I am. And the barkeeper said, no, and I don't give a good goddamn to Stagger Lee. He said, well, bartender, it's a plain to see. I'm the bad motherfucker called Stagger Lee. Mr. Stagger Lee. Well, the barkeeper said, yeah, I heard your name down the way, and I kick motherfucking asses like you every day, Mr. Stagger Lee. Well, those were the last words that the barkeeper said, 'cause they put four holes in his motherfucking head. Just then in came a broad called Nellie Brown, known to make more money than any bitch in town. Yeah. She struts across the bar, hitching up her skirt over to Stagger Lee. She's starting to flirt. Oh, Stagger Lee. She saw the barkeep, said, oh God, he can't be dead. Stag said, well, just count the holes in the motherfucker's head. She said, you ain't look like you're scored in quite a time. When I come to my bed, it won't cost you a dime, Mr. Stagger Lee. But there's something that I have to say before you begin. You have to be gone before my man Billy Dilly comes in, Mr. Stagger Lee. I'll stay here till Billy Dilly comes in, till time comes to pass. And furthermore, I'll fuck Billy Dilly in his motherfucking ass, said Stagger Lee. I'm a bad motherfucker, don't you know? And I'll crawl over 50 good pussies just to get to one fat boy's asshole, said Stagger Lee. Just then Billy Billy rolls in, he says, you must be the man motherfucker called Stagger Lee. I'm Stagger Lee. Yeah, I'm Stagger Lee. Get down on your knees and suck my dick, because if you don't, you're gonna be dead, said Stagger Lee. Oh well, Billy Billy dropped down and slobbered on his head, and Stag filled him full of lead. Oy.
What do you reckon happens to lost buttons? Because they're not in the washing machine. Hey, like, they've just gone away to the land of lost socks or something. A mystical pocket dimension of lint and broken dreams. This coat's got a lost button. I hope you're happy out there, bud.
Yeah. It's still a $2 coat check, mate. You're holding up the line.
Check yourself before you wreck yourself. 95BFM is running the coat check at Laneway. $2 for in and out, $5 with pass outs. Look for the big BFM bus.
You look different.
Cheers, yeah, I got a new haircut.
No, it's not that. You're like
way hotter.
Okay.
And I respect you more. Also, you look smarter and better at sports.
I mean, I got a B-card.
That's it! Yup, the B-card.
The B-card.
The B-card.
It's how you win sick prizes. It's how you get incredible discounts. And it's how you help us stay on a platform for awesome, out-there music, hard-hitting news, and the odd bit of cheeky nonsense. Sign up for a B-card for just $4.20 a month and support independent media. Go to 95bfm.com/sign up.
The Wire.
I don't know. And frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Yes, welcome back to The Wire. And very quickly in our final story, there was an announcement by the Children's Commissioner, Andrew Beacoff, this morning. So I'm just going to leave it to him with everything that he told me, summing it up. So I know that the analysis of the Oranga Tamariki data is only descriptive at this point. So we'll start more generally talking about the increasing trend towards making decisions before a baby's birth to take them into custody. The trend is greater for Māori than for non-Māori. So what is sort of your statement generally about the state of Oranga Tamariki, if this is the case?
Yeah, I think you're right. The stats overall are shocking and concerning, in particular for non-Māori babies. The rate is 2 to 3 times less than for Māori babies in terms of orders to remove unborn babies. Now, that disproportionality is massive. It raises some very big questions about, I guess, New Zealand as a whole, not just Oranga Tamariki.
Mm. The next stage of analysis of this data will seek to explain why these trends have occurred. Who will have the biggest input on that moving forward with you?
Yeah, well, there are 3 inquiries going on. They're all asking the same questions. We have already interviewed Māori families who have experienced Oranga Tamariki and child, youth and family intervention into their families and have had babies removed in some cases. We know already some of the underlying causes, long-term disadvantage dating back to the colonisation process, modern-day systemic racism. Together it's a lethal cocktail. Not just would be wrong to confine it to Oranga Tamariki. These are decisions and issues for all New Zealand, whether it's health, whether it's educational outcome, whether it's involved in the criminal justice system. We know that these stats take place in the context of disproportionate outcomes for some Māori across the board. But we also know already in our work that there are some questions to be asked about how well are Māori organisations and hapū and iwi involved in the process. Is Oranga Tamariki being involved early enough? Is there the right support being given? And is there too quick an access to court orders for removal, particularly for unborn babies? I think these are all questions, and they're all issues that have emerged, particularly in the last 5 to 10 years.
Mm. Because what are the grounds for intervention before a baby has even been born? I mean, that on face value sounds a little bit ridiculous to me.
Yeah, it's usually on the basis of past care that has been delivered to babies born previously to that mother, or it's genuine and serious concerns about what's happening inside the family before the baby is born. In fact, most New Zealanders may not know the law changed in 2014 to say that if a second or subsequent baby was born, then it was for the mother, if she'd had a baby previously removed, to demonstrate she's a fit and proper person. And that hasn't been used too often, but I think it's affected the thinking and the practice when there are second or subsequent children born and a baby's already been removed. I think there's been too quicker movement towards consideration of removal rather than what supports are required to help that mother a second time round.
Mm-hmm. So to me, that sounds like there is quite a clear kaupapa for going forward, the next steps of the review, even though there aren't yet identified areas of change or detailed recommendations. But
correct.
Can you explain if that will be more Oranga Tamariki specific, or if it will be
a more holistic recommendation for the structure of our health system as a whole?
Yeah, well, we monitor by law the policies and practices of Oranga Kamariki. That will be our focus.
Mm-hmm.
It must be by law. I would think, although I can't prejudge, that the Whanau Ora-led inquiry into Oranga Kamariki practice may be much wider, and it will be interesting to see what the Ombudsman comes up with. But all of us in different ways are asking the same question about what can we do better to ensure that wherever possible, babies remain with their mothers and with their family.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the fundamental question that has emerged from these stats. How can we arrest what's going on with the stats? How can we reduce and eliminate the disparity for Māori? Because it is a totally inequitable situation. I think most New Zealanders were galvanised in their concern through the video of the Hastings removal case.
Mm.
We know we can be better. We know this is not a New Zealand that we're proud of. Mm. I don't want that. As long as I'm in this role and have life and breath, we'll be doing all that we can, almost as a number one priority, to address this issue of disproportionality of outcomes for Māori across the board.
That was The Wire.
That was indeed The Wire for Thursday the 16th of January. Thanks for coming to my first of the year. Any passing thoughts?
No.
I just want to go raving now. That's what we've been talking about for the last few minutes.
Yeah, lazy raves in the studio.
Doof,
2020.
Doof, 2020 energy.
No, but thank you for having me on the show. Thank you for all your support and encouragement getting through that interview.
My pleasure.
Yeah. And yeah, thank you to everyone that was interviewed today for your participation.
And thank you always to Lillian Hanley, who I absolutely adore.
Yeah, shotties, Lillian.
Ka kite anō.
A 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.